I'm Jane Johnson. I started the Careering into Motherhood community for women who want a career as well as a family. I'd seen too many women leave careers and jobs that they loved because it didn't seem possible to fit it all in around childcare. I want motherhood and ambition to happily coexist. On our Facebook group, Careering into Motherhood, we've got 6,500 women now, and it's all about support, advice, and jobs. Our masterclasses and online workshops give mums the skills to build and remain in fulfilling careers. For more details on all of our upcoming programmes, including career coaching and CV writing, using LinkedIn with purpose, email me, jane@careeringintomotherhood.com. My guest today is Lucy Jurek. Lucy is the Global Head of Reputation at HSBC, one of the world's biggest brands, most recognisable brands. They're in hundreds of countries worldwide. They employ hundreds of thousands of people, and their reputation doesn't always sail smoothly. They've been in and out of hot water like any large bank. But Lucy took on this in the last 6 months. Prior to that, she has spent 10 years at the bank. And so I invited her on the podcast to talk about how you can navigate a career and move your way up the rungs in a large global organization, and how she combines that with maternity leave, having had her daughter a couple of years ago. Perhaps you could just give a bit of an overview of your career, your role at the moment, what you do, and how you kind of made it to the level that you're at the moment.
Yeah, really happy to, Jane. So I am at the moment looking after what we call the reputation team for HSBC. And that involves really looking after all the parts of the communications function that are responsible for protecting and enhancing the reputation of HSBC and how folks outside the bank perceive us. So it's a role that I've been in now for about 6 months, but I've been with the firm for over a decade, which feels quite odd to say. It does. Mm-hmm. And I've been fortunate enough to do some really interesting things for the group, which I think have made it feel very much like lots of little careers rather than one long one. Mm. But in terms of how I got here, so whistle stop tour. So I went to university in Cardiff. I was an English literature grad, and I came out of that degree really armed with a piece of paper, a bag full of debt, and honestly, not much more than that. So coming off my BA, I charmed a wonderful man called Mike Smith, who ran a PR course, a postgraduate. And I spent a year with him and 30 other young people learning about the magical world of public relations. And off the back of that, I was lucky enough to get into one of the big financial PR agencies in London, which was a fabulous training ground to cut my teeth. But it was pretty clear, I think, early on that I wanted to understand the corporate machine from the inside. I am naturally incredibly nosy. anyone who knows me will tell you. I just really like having the inside track and being super close to the action. Mm. So not long after I was recruited into that agency, I joined the Marks and Spencer press team.
Oh, did you?
I did. And it was an incredible time. It was under Sir Stuart Rose, who was an absolute force to be reckoned with. And the company was dealing with a huge number of issues that were just really fun to get stuck into. So a few years there, and then fast forward to HSBC, and I've worked across four different countries, I think in 7 or 8 roles now, across over a decade. So that kind of brings us up to today.
The way you've just described that is you went from one thing to the other to the other. But, you know, for our listeners, you are probably one of the most senior women at HSBC, looking after the reputation of the bank. Banks like to get themselves into quite a lot of hot water, and also the public, you know, they come under huge amounts of public scrutiny. So it is a big, big job that you have, Lucy. How much would you say you had a plan to get to this level, to be running this kind of, I mean, I can't imagine when you started out from university, anyone would have even envisaged that this kind of role would have existed. But how much of a planner are you when it comes to your career, and how much have you been opportunistic or pragmatic?
You know, this is such a good question, and it's a question that I feel like comes up a lot. So in terms of me, I am a huge planner. So in life, I am obsessed with planning and I'm obsessed with lists and order. In fact, my mother-in-law, who is also a avid lister, and I regularly talk about how great it feels to tick something off our list. It's a topic of conversation. But when it came to work, I think it was less about having a very explicit plan and more about two things, really, I think, that have coloured my path when I reflect on it. So the first, and it's pretty boring to say, but is just incredibly strong work ethic. So I'm a competitive person. My dad is a retired PE teacher, and I was awful and still am at all sports that he ever threw at me. But I think it's how my competitive genetics come out. I want to do something really well. And I also love doing it at pace. And both of those have turned out happily to be things that are really saleable in a corporate environment. So work ethic, I don't think you can discount. And I think in my world anyway, that has been more important than a very explicit plan. The second thing, though, which perhaps relates more to plans and decision points, is that I think I took risks and do feel quite comfortable taking risks. And what I mean by that is that sometimes role and job decisions are a bit of a leap of faith. So I was actually I was laughing with my husband Chris recently. We were doing one of those risk appetite assessments, thinking about where we were going to put our savings and how we were going to make best use of those. And I'm literally at the most risk averse end of the spectrum that you could possibly be. And he is at the opposite. So you could say that's a good match or a hideous one. But he was joking that for somebody who's conservative from a financial perspective, I've actually taken quite a lot of big life jumps. If I really kind of reflect on why that is, I suppose I trust my instincts. In my experience, good decisions about jobs happen when you listen to your gut. And then ideally also you test it with some great friends, you know, in my case, often girlfriends who don't take any BS and challenge you. And if you use gut as your indicator and then your friends and family as your kind of testers and challengers, I think you often will get to the thing that's right for you from a from a job perspective pretty quickly. So there have been some forks in the road. And I haven't always taken, I think, the obvious choice. And I think for me, that's been more important than a very clear plan.
And do you think those forks in the road, have you followed your instinct and your ambition in those where they may not have always been the obvious choice? And I think I'm right in saying, at certain times you've changed country, you've gone by yourself, you know, overseas and taken what would have been seen, as you say, you know, as high risk strategies for, and I keep coming back to this thing, which it shouldn't be, but it is, for a woman to do and to step out on her own. So how have you pathed those?
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting you say, particularly for a woman, I kind of cringe the same as you when you say that, but actually I think it is necessary to say. I mean, I remember when I told my mum that I was moving to Hong Kong on my own and the look of horror that crossed her face. And she wasn't the only person who reacted that way. So there's definitely that feeling that it's somehow braver for a woman to do. I don't know. I think thinking about forks and decisions. So there have been two times, I think, where there've been either a couple of options or a couple of different ways that I could go on the table. And the thing that I reflect on when I look at both of those times is that I have always said yes to the harder thing or the thing that will build me more. Right. And what that's meant is I haven't always said yes to the thing that I thought would bring me most enjoyment. Right. And I don't always think that those, I mean, it's really happy if those things do line up, but I'm not sure that they always do. One example of that would be when I was given the opportunity when I was in Dubai to do something that was in a slightly different capability set. It wasn't in the set of skills that I'd been already doing. It wasn't really even in the set of skills that I really thought I would enjoy. But I recognised that if I added that to my toolkit, I was probably going to be able to accelerate to a team leader role much, much quicker than if I stayed in my groove of my specialism. And I remember having a conversation with somebody and saying, oh, it feels like it's going to be a bit dull. I'm not sure that's me. And they said, well, what does the person that's one up above you have they done both of these two things, or were they a specialist? And of course, you know, they were a much more generalist, you know, had a breadth of experience. And for me, that was how I made that decision. It was not thinking about the job I'm taking now. It was thinking about, is this a better bridge to the job I want afterwards? So that was an example of where I kind of said yes to the thing perhaps that didn't excite me, but built me. And then there's another example, which was more the thing that was going to be really hard for me. And I said yes to the thing that was going to be hard. So this was where there were a couple of kind of options on the table. One was something that I thought, I'm going to love that. I've got all the skills for it. I could do it tomorrow. I'm going to have tons of fun doing it. It's a great team already. And the other was something that honestly made me think, ah, there's a ton of stuff in there that I'm going to find really difficult. I remember a CEO who I used to work with very closely saying once, I have always picked the thing that scares me, and that is how you accelerate. I kind of agree with that, I think, based on my experience anyway.
And it's a lot easier when you don't have children to be able to down sticks and go internationally. But other career forks, what's been your experience, or what have you handled them differently or thought them through differently since you married and had children?
I mean, it changes everything, doesn't it? I think it's, well, for me, it's been fundamental in terms of what I value and openly how selfish or not you can be. I think A, you don't want to be as selfish anymore, and B, practically you just can't. I mean, if I were to come home now and say there's this brilliant thing and it's in Singapore and I'd really love to go and do it, you know, Chris would laugh at me, and we wouldn't get very far with that conversation, because, you know, he also has a brilliant job that he loves. And everything we do now, and this is actually maybe back to the planning point, needs to be a lot more planned and considered and with a longer lead time. So I would say that I am less flexible, not perhaps less flexible full stop, but less flexible without planning. But I would say that some of those things that I've just talked about still stand. So actually, where I was talking about taking a job that scared me a little bit more, I was actually talking about the most recent job that I have taken at HSBC, and that was only 6 months ago. So that was certainly in the child period of our lives. So I think I'm not as able to do things, you know, on the turn of a dime, but I'm certainly still in that place where I don't want to do the thing that feels necessarily easy.
I'm really excited that our new Careering into Motherhood website is launching, and you will find details of all the coaching programs that we run and the masterclass sessions. These are all about helping you address and navigate some of the topics that we talk about in the podcasts. Our forthcoming career coaching program is starting in September. We've also got one on using LinkedIn and writing your CV. And we've got a very exciting one starting in October, which is all around preparing your career for maternity leave. Take a look at our website, www.careeringintomotherhood.com. Can I come back to the point you made about being competitive? Firstly, as a woman, how comfortable are you with saying, I am a competitive woman? How do you feel that lands with other women? And then also, again, I'm a competitive woman and I'm a mother. Have you encountered any bias, any extra support around any of this stuff?
Yeah, this is a biggie, isn't it? I love this topic because I think that I have my own bias here as well. So First question, I suppose, how comfortable do I feel saying I'm competitive? I would say increasingly I do, but that hasn't been a thing that I have felt forever. And actually, I think part of getting comfortable with that has been linked to, you know, proving myself in a working environment and almost kind of showing, not telling. So I think I'm confident saying I'm competitive now. If you'd asked me at the beginning of my career, I would have said that probably I wouldn't have got a good reaction, and I would have used other words. I would have shielded that word with things like ambition and work ethic and all of that good stuff that somehow feels more palatable. My own personal view is that people, women and men, don't always react particularly well to the idea of a competitive woman. It somehow feels a bit distasteful. And if you put side by side some of the I suppose, demonstrable behaviours of competition in a man and in a woman, it isn't always as palatable when you see them in a woman. And I know that because I sometimes have that reaction when I encounter another competitive woman. But I think really it's up to you as the individual who wants to have a career and compete in a healthy way, by the way, to actually own that a little bit. You can't expect these natural bias situations to change unless you personally own it, you talk about it, you use the word without, you know, fear. And I think the other thing that has been really important to me is that competition and being competitive can happily coexist with being a great coach and a great mentor and a real believer in other people. And for me, it's, I suppose, been the pairing of those two things that I think A, brings my personality more to life so I can be really me at work, and B, also makes that competitive piece palatable for people who might have a natural bias against it.
No, it's a really, really interesting topic. We've actually got Viv Grosskopf, who's coming to do a masterclass for Careering into Motherhood, who's written an entire book about this called Lift As You Climb, Women and the Art of Ambition. And it's all about how it is possible to be competitive, ambitious, whichever adjective you want to use, and still help others along the way. So it's really interesting to hear you're actually in business and doing it.
I like getting competitive on behalf of other people. So that's partly as well, I think, a bit of an unlock. I wonder whether she talks about this. So for me, competition isn't just me being competitive with myself. I love being part of a team that's, you know, really cooking on gas and doing great things, and that other people around me are getting their own recognition and promotion and feel like they're really motoring forward. That for me is a really, really good feeling, and it releases a lot of energy. So it's kind of competition in the broadest sense, not just in this defined, you know, for me and on behalf of me. I think that's really important.
Yeah, definitely. Which kind of comes onto this idea of sponsorship. And again, as in Viv's book, there's a whole chapter on sponsorship versus mentoring and how important it is for women or people coming in, people from any sort of diverse background, anyone who is in a minority. Sponsorship is such a hugely powerful piece of support that we can all offer.
Yeah, so spoiler alert, I think this is probably the single most important thing if you are going to build a long-term career in a large corporate. I think it's probably important in lots of other types of careers as well, but because my personal experience is in a large corporate, that's the piece I draw on. But this for me has been so important. I'm a great believer in making your own luck and your own success, but it wouldn't be realistic for me to say that I would be where I am today without great sponsors. So my experience is that the best sponsor relationships anyway that I've had have grown pretty organically, actually, out of existing either work or management relationships, and that they've grown from a base of real trust both ways, in terms of me liking and respecting the individual, but also in terms of me delivering, you know, what I've said I'm going to deliver for that individual or for the team. So kind of mutual respect as the grounding. Often some personal chemistry and connection as well, I think, is a indicator that this is going to be a good long-term sponsor relationship. I think you have to recognize it's a two-way street. So this person has to enjoy being with you, which sounds really basic, but they have to like you. They have to think that what you're bringing is great. They have to, you know, enjoy your energy. They might even see themselves in you a little bit, not always, but that might be one of the things that makes it work. You might even make them feel good or bring something to them that is an alternative perspective that's additive. So I think if you build from a base of respect, if you create chemistry, or not create it, but you have it. And then if you know when to pivot that really strong base into asking for something, those are kind of the three magic ingredients, I think. And when you pivot it into that asking for something, that's when the relationship becomes really powerful, because it's not simply, you know, the coach or the mentor conversation. They are going to help you do something. They're going to do that from a position of greater power, greater influence, greater seniority, and they're going to supercharge your own ambition. So I think those three ingredients are super important, and for me sponsorship has been everything.
It's really interesting, that point about how and when to ask. I'm sure a lot of our listeners would be really interested in your experience of that. Is it just, and again, from a comms perspective, this is right in your sweet spot. So, you know, you don't bounce somebody with it cold at the water cooler. You know, is it something you've done by email? Is it something you've done inviting the person out for lunch or for a coffee? You know, what's been your experience? And is it even a formal conversation, or is it something that has just gradually evolved into a more sponsorship type relationship?
For me, actually, it has been that more organic evolution where there's been a natural moment, I think, where you say, okay, this person actually respects me enough for me to ask for their support and their active, proactive help. Because back to that point on it being a two-way street, it is a bit of a transaction. You are asking for something. So there does need to be either goodwill or something in it for them. I think organic is best if it can happen, but I'm also a realist, and that might not always be the case. And you might have a situation where you really need to close the gap in your network and find a sponsor who can help you with something, and that person is not currently in your sphere. I think when that happens, you do need to back yourself a little bit and think about what is it that you can bring to the relationship as you make that connection. And you probably need to feel your way through instinctively as to when is the time to ask. I am a big believer that, you know, email one, water cooler moment one is not the time. I've had some really cringy conversations with people, you know, who've said, hey, Lucy, I hear you have worked in four different countries. I want to go and have a career in New York. So I'm going to put time in your diary and you're going to tell me how to do that. Yeah. And, you know, there's a nib in there, which is could be the start of a relationship, but that's not for me. Yeah. That's not the way to go about it. Yeah. You've got to build a little bit of warmth, a little bit of intimacy first.
With my limited experience as well on that side, it's being specific about what you're asking for, because there's nothing worse than being asked to just kind of generally sponsor somebody in anything and everything they want to do. Whereas it's, you know, picking something, as you say, where you know that person has done that or has particular web of network in that area that could help you, and just saying, look, it will be for this particular time or this particular occasion.
Just on that point about being specific, actually, it's a really good reminder, because even if you have had previous, you know, mentor or sponsorship relationships and you know you need to be specific, it's really easy to slip into the habit of then just going more general. So an example of this, a brilliant woman actually who I recently met, she kind of wafted into my life like a whirlwind of wisdom. she runs a company actually that has the sole purpose of getting more women into CEO roles. Right. An incredible individual. She recently pointed out to me that there is zero point building your network if nobody in that network knows how to help you. And the point that she was making was that most people actually really like helping out. They get a bit of a buzz from it. It gives them good energy, but they can't help you if they don't know what you need. So it's not necessarily about saying, here is my 5-year plan on a one pager for you to keep in your wallet. But it is about saying, you know, here's what I think the next step might look like, or here are the types of people I need to connect with in order to do the next thing. And then when they're out and about on their travels and meeting people, they might meet somebody and they'll have that light bulb of, ooh, this person could really help Lucy. Yes. And you've activated them then. You need to use them with purpose.
Yeah, yep, that's exactly it. I want to come on to a little bit of, I guess, your personal setup. Obviously, you and your husband both work. You both have very demanding careers. And talk a little bit about how you manage that and your return to work after maternity leave. You know, you must have sat down and had the conversation. Was it ever a question that you might take slightly longer off, or that you may not go back? Just all this stuff around how motherhood has changed or not your own career ambition and leadership style.
Wow, you go deep, don't you, Jane? That's a big question. In fact, I think there were three. I know. So maybe I'll take the coming back from mat leave bit first. So, I mean, pre-mat leave, I'm not in any way ashamed to admit I was incredibly nervous about stepping away. I was really anxious. I'll be honest and say I'd actually put off having a baby for a little while. I mean, not That's long, but a little while, because I had this feeling that if I could get a little bit higher before I went, it would somehow be easier. And I don't think it was any easier. I mean, maybe I felt a little bit better about it myself, but it was still quite nerve-wracking. And I, as a person anyway, get FOMO. So I was convinced that I would be forgotten, had a massive fear of missing out. I was thinking, oh, I'm not going to want to disconnect. I'm going to want to keep my work email and, you know, all of these things. I mean, looking back, some of that was supremely idiotic, because from the moment my daughter arrived, I couldn't care less about what was going on in the big bad world of HSBC. And I, you know, I just didn't want to know for a few months. I was so engrossed in everything that was happening and just getting to grips with that.
But did you do anything before you went, therefore, to shore up your career, or in that interim, in that 9 months before you had your baby, what did you do? This is really interesting for so many of our listeners, because I think so many of us do feel that panic about, I'm going to be overlooked. I'll never forget, someone said to me once, don't tell them how long you're going to be off. Say you think you'll be around 4 to 6 months, because you're not legally obliged to say, and people can get their heads around that length of time, because lots of people have sabbaticals for that amount of time. And that fear of being forgotten or kind of shut out of key decisions was very real for me as well.
Yeah, and I think certainly for me, and I think for you, Jane, when so much of your identity is wrapped up in who you are at work and the career that you've built and the network that you have built around that, it can be quite just scary to think, am I anymore without any of those things on a day-to-day basis? So I think before I went, and I will say, actually, my husband Chris was amazing in this scenario, because he could see the anxiety building, and he was really the only person that I felt comfortable talking to about the anxiety. You know, I think it's really just about making sure that you have somebody who is either looking after your role, or if they're not covering you directly, the team that makes you feel good and confident. So number one is, do I have the confidence that I can step away and this isn't going to immediately become, you know, a mess and therefore reflect badly on me? So number one is, you know, find somebody brilliant to cover you who you really, really trust, or if not, set yourself up for success from that perspective, because that is one of the things that you can have a little bit more input over. So focus on the things you can control rather than things that you can't. The second is that network piece, and just making sure that on that day that you leave, you walk out of there feeling like you've got a set of people behind you who know you well, who know what you bring to an organization, who have your best interests at heart, and then trusting them a little bit, trusting them to do the right thing, to you know, keep you in mind for anything that might need to be talked about while you're away, and also bring them in a little bit while you are away. So if appropriate and as it feels right for you, share news about the baby, and don't feel like you need to keep that completely isolated. I was so just warmly and pleasantly surprised by how many people, particularly in the leadership team that I was working with at the time in the retail bank, just had so much to talk to me about as a parent, because many of them were parents and they wanted to talk about it too. And just opening up that avenue actually created a huge amount of connectivity and kind of mutual, you know, common ground between us that actually we didn't have before. And so it wasn't something to be scared about talking about. It's actually something that created a closeness that perhaps hadn't been there before. So I think control what you can control and try and not sweat the rest. And then, you know, leave your network live and warm, and don't be afraid of reaching out while you're away to keep that alive as well. And beyond that, honestly, you've just got to recognize so many people do it, and feel the anxiety to do it anyway.
What a fascinating chat there with Lucy. I loved the advice that she gave around finding sponsors, sponsorship, around preparing your career for maternity leave, and on being and saying that you are a competitive or ambitious woman in business. Lots of interesting and great content in there. And I'm really grateful to Lucy for actually being so candid in her chat with me. I hope that this inspires lots more of you to go out there and go for what you want.